الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم. رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقهوا قولي. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته, dear brothers, sisters and friends. Let me begin by thanking Sheffield University Science Society for inviting me again to deliver today a lecture on the history of the Ottoman dynasty. Now, what dynasty? Yeah, I heard someone mention dynasty. Let me begin by saying that there is in no shape or form can I deliver a history of the Ottoman dynasty in any serious depth with the time that I have. In fact, if I was given 4 or 5 hours, I still wouldn't be able to deliver any justice to the depth that's really required to understand the Ottoman dynasty, or any dynasty for that matter. Entire books, lectures, series, podcasts have been dedicated to certain periods of Ottoman history. But what I will try my best today is to give you all an overview of the history of the Ottoman Empire, with key events, key incidents, and some key discussion points. And inshallah, it should be a starter for any of you who want to pursue further research into the Ottomans. Now, the history of the Ottoman dynasty has to begin with the dream of Osman. Now, in front of you, you all should have a handout, and the first thing that's on the handout in italics should be the dream of Osman. Now, let me tell you about the dream of Osman. Now, Osman I, rahimahullah, he was the first Ottoman ruler, the first Ottoman sultan. And one night, when he was a young man, he was spending the night with a very prominent scholar of Anatolia called Sheikh Edebali, rahimahullah, who later became his father-in-law. And he spent a night at the Sheikh's house, and that night he had a dream. And the dream was that a full moon left the chest of the Sheikh and entered Osman's chest. And when that full moon entered his chest, a tree began to grow from his navel. And that tree continued to grow. And within this dream, Osman saw very iconic regions, which later on the Ottomans would go on to rule. For example, in his dream, he saw Mount Atlas, Mount Taurus, the Mount Caucasus. He also saw a number of iconic rivers, the River Nile, the River Danube, the Euphrates, the Tigris. And this tree continued to grow. And it continued to grow under the light of a crescent. And as it was growing, towards the end of the dream, there was a muadhin who made the adhan. This was Osman's dream. When he awoke, he conveyed this dream to Sheikh Edebali, who interpreted it as follows. He said, "My son, I in this dream represented knowledge. The full moon which left my chest to yours would be the knowledge that will be passed from myself and generally the ulama, the scholars, over to your household. That tree which spread from your navel will be the great state that your progeny will go on to establish. And those rivers and those mountainous regions that you saw, you will, or your progeny will, go on to conquer these lands. And the crescent upon which the light shone upon the tree is Islam. And the muadhin who made the adhan means that there will come a point where this state of yours will be the only legitimate Islamic authority on this earth." That's how the dream was interpreted by Sheikh Edebali. From this point onward, every single Ottoman ruler had this vision. In fact, it became the underlying philosophy of the Ottoman Empire and its state, that they would go on to continue to expand, that they perceived themselves as a legitimate Islamic authority, and that So as long as the justice of Islam was upheld in the lands in which they ruled, this state will continue to expand. That is basically where most books and literature about the Ottomans begins. It begins with Osman's dream. However, for those of you who perhaps may be watching a hit Turkish show called Deriliş Ertuğrul, you know that, okay, maybe the history of the Ottomans actually began before Osman, and you'd be correct. So Osman's father was Ghazi Ertuğrul, rahimahullah, a very great leader. May Allah have mercy on his soul. Ameen. And he initially built the blueprint to what was going to become the Ottoman state. And for those of you who are watching Deriliş Ertuğrul, you know that before they became known as the Ottomans or Osmanli, they were known as the Kayyis. The Kayyi tribe was one of many Turkic tribes who began in the steppes of Central Asia. They were one of many. And they all traced their lineage back to an individual called Oğuz Han. Now, for those of you who attended the Uyghur lecture, I also mentioned that the Uyghurs did trace their lineage back to Oğuz Han. Oğuz Han was not Muslim, by the way. So he was considered as the founding father of the Turkic race. So the Kayyis were one of many of these tribes that made up a nomadic confederation. And due to nomadic lifestyle, they migrated to different parts of the world. So for example, the Uyghurs, they migrated eastwards towards Pakistan or China or Xinjiang, however you want to pronounce it. Others headed southwards towards Central Asia and Iran, whereas other Turkic tribes, they migrated westwards towards Anatolia for different reasons. And eventually when the Kayyis arrived in Anatolia, Anatolia was under the control of the Seljuk Sultanate of Rum. Now the Seljuks were another powerful and prominent Turkic Muslim Sultanate. And the Seljuk Sultanate of Rum basically just means the Seljuk state of Rome or Europe. And the Kayyis had settled in the borders of the Seljuk state, which bordered the Byzantine Empire. And they were under the protectorate of the Seljuk Empire. Now, we're talking here late 12th century, early 13th century. Now, as the Seljuk Empire was rapidly declining as a result of internal disputes and warfare, as well as the Mongol onslaught that came from the east, after the Seljuk Empire eventually was abolished, what was left in the remnants of Anatolia were small little beyliks. Yeah. Again, for those of you who are watching the video, you know some of this land, Beylik, yeah? It means a small principality state. In essence, these Beyliks was what the Seljuks had essentially given many of the Turkic tribes as a kind of semi-autonomous towns, perhaps cities, where they would essentially run those respective areas in alignment with Seljuk policy. So after the Seljuks had essentially demised, the Kayyis established their Beylik, which then went on to or evolved into the Ottoman Sultanate. Now, as I mentioned in the beginning of the lecture, I really, really cannot give any serious justice or depth to this topic. Because, you know, historians were literally of Western secular Muslim scholars and academics literally have dedicated entire books in just like small periods of Ottoman history. Some scholars have dedicated entire literature just on one ruler. So I will try my best to essentially give you guys an overview of the most important events, right? And that's not to say that the events or the timeline that you got in front of you in that slide is all the important events that had taken place within the Ottoman Empire, the Ottoman dynasty. You have to keep in mind that the Ottomans were around from 1299 to 1924. That's a huge period of history. However, I have identified the following events to be something of importance So if I go in order, so 1299 was when Sultan Osman, he made the Beylik into an official state, a state which was not dependent on any other superpower or empire of the time. That was in 1299. In 1402 to 1413, we had the Ottoman Interregnum, which is basically the Ottoman Civil War. That is when the three sons of Murad I, who I will touch upon who he is in the next slide. Murad I was the grandson of Osman, and he was a very powerful Ottoman ruler. He got into a war with a leader called Timurlain. Timurlain is someone who is of Mongol Turkic ethnicity, and the Mughal dynasty of India traced their lineage back to Timurlain. Anyway, the Ottomans were defeated by Timur, the Timur Empire. And in the aftermath of that war, the three sons of Murad, they began a civil war and a power struggle as to who would assume power after the capture of their father. Now, the reason why this period is so important is because it was in these 11 years that the Ottoman state nearly self-imploded. It was in this period that the Ottoman state literally nearly ceased to exist because of the civil war. How many Muslims and non-Muslims that were killed in the civil war, the fact that the three brothers had allied themselves with European entities that traditionally were their rivals. It was a very, very bloody period, and it was a period which, as I mentioned, nearly destroyed the state. And it was out of this period that there was a policy called the royal fratricide, whereby Ottoman princes, known as Shahzadeh, they would kill their brothers. It was a state policy that to avoid civil war, to avoid the state from self-imploding, to protect the unity of the state, that we would kill our brothers to not have a repetition of this incident, which nearly destroyed what our forefathers had built. 1453 is perhaps the most important event, not only in Ottoman history, perhaps one of the most important events in Islamic history. And that was when the Ottomans, under the leadership of Sultan Mehmed II, rahimahullah, they conquered Constantinople. And that is because that conquest was prophesied by our beloved Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam in a hadith which was narrated by Abu Ayyub al-Ansari radiallahu anhu, who's actually buried in Istanbul today. And to paraphrase this hadith, our beloved Prophet said that indeed the Muslims will conquer Constantinople, and the ruler and the leader who takes Constantinople will be a great leader, and those who fight under him will be a great army. And you find that Sahaba, even at that time, raced and competed with one another to fulfill this prophecy. But it was Mehmed II, rahimahullah, who fulfilled that prophecy. In 1517, Sultan Selim I became the first Khalifa of the Ottoman dynasty, when he defeated the Mamluks in the Battle of Marj Dabik in Syria today, and he forcibly made the last Abbasid Khalif, Mutawakkil III, abdicate, and he declared the Ottoman state as the Khilafah. So as you can see on top of that timeline, 1299 to 1517, the Ottoman state was known as a Sultanate. And from 1517 to 1924, the Ottoman state was the Khilafah. And there were no other competing caliphates during that period. So when I mention Sultanate or Caliphate from the period 1517 onwards, I'm using them interchangeably. Though Sultanate was the kind of imperial term used to describe the Ottoman state, whereas the Khilafet or the Khilafah was the kind of religious term used to describe the same, but essentially it was the same thing, and I will use them interchangeably from the period 1517 onward. 1740 to 1768 was a very interesting period in Ottoman history, because there was this period of peace, for 28 years, for the first time since 1299, the Ottomans were not in a state of war. I want you guys to think about that for a moment. From 1299 to 1740, the Ottoman state was in a constant state of warfare. Mainly offensive, but also defensive. But it was literally all fronts, never ending. But there was this period of peace. And the reason why this period is very interesting is that a number of historians, and I also hold this position, that it was this period of peace where the decline of the Ottomans began, at least from a military perspective. 1839 to 1876 saw the period of the Tanzimat reforms. Now, the Tanzimat reforms was a set of liberal reforms which were aggressively sought to be implemented within the Ottoman state. It was the first time in Ottoman history whereby elements of the Ottoman elite sought solutions, ideas from Western Europe, namely France. And so there was an aggressive and growing movement, which are known as the Young Turks, that sought to implement these changes. And two sultans were actually supportive of the Tanzimat reforms, and we can discuss this in a later slide. 1914, when Germany declared war with its neighbors, the Ottomans sided with Germany. It also needs to be made clear that the decision for the Ottomans to go to war and side with the Germans was not that of the Sultan or the Khalifa at the time. By that time, the Ottoman state was being run by three individuals. They were known famously as the three Pashas, and they were part of the Young Turk movement. And it was they who made the decision, essentially, to enter World War I to side with Germany. And of course, they lost. They were defeated. And in 1922, we saw the Sultanate, the Ottoman Sultanate, the imperial institution, dissolved. In 1923, we saw the Treaty of Lausanne, which basically was the partitioning of former Ottoman territories that were then handed over to Britain and France that became British and French mandates. And last but not least, in 1924, we saw the abolishment of the Ottoman Caliphate. And that was the last event in Ottoman history. Notable rulers. All in all, there were 36 sultans. Out of 36 sultans, 28 of them were khulafa. So from Osman the First to the 8th sultan, they were all sultans. They were never khalifs. So we know when we talk about the Ottomans, I've heard it in some circles, when we talk about the Ottomans, there's a mistake there, the Ottoman Caliphate. When you say the Ottoman Caliphate, you need to be specifically talking about the period of 1517 onward. Because 1299 to 1516, there was no Ottoman Caliphate. It was the Ottoman Sultanates. And so from the 36 rulers, there were 28 Khalifs. And they all were known for something or another. But I identified the following 10 for a number of important reasons. Osman I, the founding father of the state. Murad I. Murad I was the third Sultan and the grandson of Osman. Now, if Ertugrul Ghazi, rahimahullah, was regarded as the person who created the blueprint, the beylik, of what was going to become the Ottoman state, and Osman I was the one who established the Ottoman state, it was Murad I who essentially identified the state by building its institutions, by building its structures, by winning key strategic battles, by expanding the state rapidly, especially in the Balkans. It was under Murad I where Kosovo, Bosnia, Serbia, Albania, as well as a number of key Byzantine cities were taken. It was also under Murad I that he created and established the Janissaries. Now, I will discuss who the Janissaries were later on, but just to let you guys know what they were an elite fighting corps within the Ottoman military. Of course, Mehmed II, known as the Conqueror, the person who fulfilled the prophecy, but also the individual who implemented and began the policy of fratricide. I know it's sometimes a bit crazy to understand that the great ruler that our beloved prophet had prophesied that would conquer Constantinople was also the Sultan who introduced the policy of fratricide. Khalif Selim I, the first Khalifa of the Ottoman dynasty. Suleiman I, known as Al-Qanuni, known as the Magnificent in European discourse. It was he who took the Ottoman state to its absolute zenith in terms of expansion. But it was also Khalif Suleiman, because he's known as Al-Qanuni, or in Turkish, the lawgiver, translated, it was he who codified Ottoman law. It was he who got rid of certain nomadic and tribal rituals and practices and norms. He got rid of them, which he felt were in contradiction to Islam. He got rid of those Turkic practices, which influenced Ottoman law. He codified Hanafi fiqh as an integral part of how the Ottoman state would make laws. And he also distinguished between different courts. Now, in European discourse, you know, he's described as the Sultan who secularized Ottoman law, and that's incorrect. It's incorrect because the vast majority of European academia, they apply a kind of secular liberal paradigm or framework, usually around the notion of the nation state, in understanding how lawmaking and legislation worked in the Ottoman Empire. When in fact, what Khalif Suleiman actually did was that he basically gathered all the ulama, he gathered all the judges, and he basically said, those aspects of our religion and those laws which are clear cut beyond deniability, where it is clear in text and clear in meaning, these will make up the Sharia court, and this will be the highest court in the land. And then we will have the Milla courts. These are the courts for the Jews and Christians, who they can resolve their disputes in these courts, and if they're unhappy with the decision, they can refer back to the Ottoman courts. And then he had a third court, which the Europeans described as the civil courts. But essentially, this was a court which dealt with mu'amalat and other civil issues. But the qudha, the judges, would still have to refer back to Islamic source texts in trying to ascertain a ruling for particular matters. This is something that's usually omitted when discussing the role of Khalif Suleiman. And it was also under Khalif Suleiman that he prioritized huge budgets for the renovation, for the infrastructure of key Islamic cities like Cairo, like Damascus, like Makkah, Medina, and Jerusalem. For those of you who have been to Umrah or Hajj or been to Jerusalem, you'll see that there's a lot of architecture that's still there from Khalif Suleiman's time. Who's been Istanbul here? What is the name of the famous mosque in the square?
Sultan Ahmed.
Yes. So that's named after Sultan Ahmed I. And it was Sultan Ahmed I who abolished the policy of fratricide. He ended that. He ended that kind of policy whereby brothers would kill brothers. Because he said, and he was of the thinking, that there must be a better way to deal with internal disputes and civil wars and the risk of brothers fighting one another than having to kill them. And whilst he appreciated the reasons why his forefathers had implemented this policy, because of the unity of the state, because of the unity of the Ummah, to prevent civil war, to prevent outsiders from interfering into the affairs of the Ottoman state, he said there must be a better way. So his policy was that if brothers could not be reasoned with one another, the one who is naturally going to assume power with the support of Ahl al-Hali wal-Aqd, which basically means the powerful elements of the Ottoman state, if they were not going to back some of the princes, they would be given an influential position in the frontiers, not within the inner parts of the state, within the frontiers. So communication was very minimal between the key players within the Ottoman state and the prospect and the princes who could potentially collude and create problems, or they were just put into exile. However, Sultan Ahmed, he ended the policy of fratricide. Khalif Murad IV, very interesting Ottoman ruler. He was the last Ottoman ruler to have led an army in battle in person. Prior to this, this was a norm, that the Khalif or the Sultan would lead the armies in battle. He was the last one to have done this. After that, that practice was kind of abandoned. He was known as the Puritan. And the reason why he was known as the Puritan is because he had, during those times, regarded as some strict and conservative views. For example, he banned public hammams. Public hammams are basically public bathing places whereby you can go and clean yourself, potentially get some massages, etc. He banned that. He said, look, this can't be happening because there's no clear segregation between the different sexes. And even if there was, these kind of environments could potentially start indecent behavior. So he banned hammams. Now hammams, at those times, were essentially used for those who could not bathe and clean themselves regularly. Usually for the poor. That when they had to make ghusl or they had to clean themselves, they had access to the public hammams. But he banned those. He also banned the playing of instruments and music in the markets. He also banned the production and the sale of alcohol in the Jewish and Christian quarters. That whilst, you know, even under Islamic law, there is some room for Jews and Christians and people of the book to consume alcohol and buy and sell alcohol, there is some grounds for that. He banned that. He said, it's not happening. There's going to be no alcohol in my state. So he was known as the Puritan. Many of these policies were then overturned very shortly after his passing. Selim III. Khalif Selim III was known as the reformer, because it was he who actually began the kind of thinking of seeking reform and ideas and solutions from Europe. He was the one that actually inspired the Tanzimat reforms. But he was assassinated. He was killed. And one of the reasons why it is believed he was killed by the Janissaries, because one of the reforms he wanted to implement was to get rid of and abolish the Janissary corps. But it was his son, Mahmud II, who was known as the Modernist. It was he who started actualizing and implementing some of the Tanzimat reforms. Not all of them, but he got that ball rolling. And some of the reforms that he implemented was changes to the Ottoman military uniform, the prohibition of soldiers keeping beards, but instead keeping just mustaches. In terms of headwear, he got rid of what was generally worn like a Turkish type of a turban. He got rid of that and incorporated more European style dress code. He began the discussions of finishing the millet system and instead having one centralized legal court for all citizens. And it was he who eventually ultimately banished and destroyed and killed the Janissary corps. Now, we have to understand, brothers and sisters, that when the Ottoman state was entering a period of decline, that some of the individuals that we can now look at in hindsight and refer to as European agents or secularists and sellouts and all that kind of stuff, these were individuals who were well-meaning. They wanted to revive their state. They wanted to have the state in which their forefathers had built and created to have further longevity, for it to survive, for it to modernize, for it to be with it alongside its European counterparts. However, they sought answers and solutions from Europe. And it was problematic because there was a number of cultural and religious clashes. That's why the Tanzimat reforms never really fully got implemented. So when we talk about even the Young Turks, the Young Turk movement, which if you speak to certain elements within Turkish society, or even those who are Islamic scholars or thinkers, you know, they'll speak very badly of the Young Turks, and rightfully so to some degree. But the movement began as an attempt, to keep the state alive. It's just that they sought the answers in the wrong place. And for sure, many of them were. Many of them were later on in collusion with European powers. And last but not least, Khalif Abdul Hamid rahimahullah, who is known as the last great Khalifa, period in Islamic history. Why? Because it was Khalif Abdul Hamid and his radical reforms and his risk approach, which actually there's like a unanimous agreement amongst all Ottoman historians that Sultan Abdul Hamid's policies literally allowed the Ottoman state to survive for another 40 years. During his reign, he nearly cleared the internal debt of the Ottoman state. But what made Khalif Abdul Hamid more unique was that he re-exerted the importance of the role of the Khalifa. He understood that the Ottoman state was in a state of decline, that the nationalist fervor was spreading like wildfire in different parts of the empire. And he thought to himself, how do I unify and keep the state intact? So he re-exerted the importance of the Khalifa. And for every citizen of the Ottoman state to be known as Ottoman citizens, to not see themselves as Jews and Christians or Bosniak or Kosovan or Greek or Armenian, everyone was an Ottoman citizen, a citizen of the Ottoman state. But beyond that, Abdul Hamid also built key strategic relationships with different parts of the Muslim world. It was known that he gave money and supported many of the resistance movements in India that fought the British. It has been recorded that many of the very early Darul Ulooms and many of the movement that's known as the Diobandis in India, that he supported them with wealth and weapons. It is known that he sent weapons and money to the Uyghurs who were fighting the Manchu Empire. He tried rebuilding relations with the Muslims of Sudan and Somalia and Yemen, because these lands had either broken away from the Ottoman state or they had essentially didn't want to be ruled by the Ottomans no longer. But he re-exerted that importance. He reminded not just his own state but the Muslims beyond that there is a religious obligation to not only pledge allegiance to the Khalifa but to obey him and support him. And this was a problem for the European powers, because Khalif Abdul Hamid was very smart. He used these key strategic relationships to cause problems for the Europeans who were making advances in other parts of the world. It should also be noted that Khalif Abdul Hamid, he had a number of assassination attempts and coup attempts against his reign. And after his reign ended, there was no longer any executive authority that any of the Ottoman rulers had over the state. There were four capitals of the Ottoman state. It's debatable whether Sogut is regarded as a capital, but it was the first established city of the Beylik and the Sultanate. Osman the First, rahimahullah, he founded Bursa. Bursa is where he is buried, and Sogut is where Ertuğrul Ghazi, his father, is buried. It was Osman's grandson, Murad the First, who then moved the capital to Edirne or Adrianopolis in 1363. And of course, the last capital city of the Ottoman state was Istanbul. All of these cities are in modern day Turkey. Characteristics of the Ottoman state. As I mentioned at the beginning of this lecture, Osman's dream was very clear. If that incident happened, and that dream happened, which I hope, I'm sure it did. But if it happened, and that's how it was interpreted by Sheikh Edebali, that was the philosophy which defined the Ottoman state. It was, without a shadow of a doubt, a religious Islamic state. There's a whole discourse around whether the Ottomans were a legitimate Islamic state or a legitimate Khilafah, or whether they were just another kingship rule. There's many of these discussions that are happening. And are happening not just within Western European academics, but even within Islamic discourse amongst ulama and activists. There's a whole discussion about how Islamic were the Ottomans. Let me tell you guys something. You know, in hindsight, it's very easy to look back at historical events and say, you know what, that wasn't Islamic, that doesn't seem Islamic, that's not orthodox, da 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 da. In the same way that 100, 150, 200 years on from our time now, there may be Muslims that look back to some of the rulings that we follow today, and we look back and I think, whoa, those were some crazy rulings they followed. That had no Islamic basis. The point I'm trying to make here is that the Ottomans, they govern their state according to their interpretation of Sharia. And it is unequivocally documented of the key role that the ulama played in the Ottoman state. You all in your handout, there's a recommended reading list. There's one very interesting book, one of my favorites. It was written by an Ottomanist historian called Hussein Yilmaz. And he wrote a book called The Caliphate Redefined, a Turn in Ottoman Political Thought. In this book, he defined and discusses, by referring back to primary sources, how the Ottoman state perceived itself. And he spoke about how the Ottoman state was uniquely and distinctly different to other dynasties before it. Why? Because no other state had codified Hanafi fiqh, or any fiqh of any madhab. Previously, you had empires and caliphates who had adopted certain madhab or certain schools of thought, but none codified it into state law. The Ottomans did that. They were also followers of the Maturidi theology, or the Maturidi school of creed. And they were unashamedly and unapologetically Sufi, people of tasawwuf. And a number of Sufi tariqas flourished under the Ottoman state, and they played a key role in defining Ottoman statehood. In fact, one of the descriptions which the Ottomans had described their state was the eternal state. Just like that tree in Osman's dream, which never actually stopped growing, they perceived their state as the eternal state. So without a shadow of a doubt, however you want to argue it, however you want to stretch the argument, with the advantage of hindsight, the Ottomans, they governed their state according to their interpretation of Sharia law. And you'll find that it was in European discourse that the Ottomans were very commonly referred to as the Turks, the Turks, the Turks. The Ottomans themselves never referred to themselves as Turks. Maybe in some poetry they did, but in state documents and in documents from one state to another, they perceive themselves as the rulers of the Islamic world, as the only legitimate rulers of the Islamic world. And whilst they were proud of their Turkic lineage, they were always pan-Islamic in their mindset. And that reflected in the language. For example, the Seljuks, the previous great Turkish empire, the official language of the courts was Persian, whereas the language of the Ottoman courts was initially was Arabic, and then it became Ottoman Turkish, which is a mix of Arabic and the Turkic language. It was also an expansionist state. You know, the fact that tree in Osman's dream just carried on growing and spreading, you know, it did have a world view to take over the whole world. The Ottoman rulers did. They, know, they wrote about it in their poetry. They wanted, they perceived themselves as the upholders of justice, and they wanted, they saw themselves as the domains of Islam, Darul Islam, and they wanted to spread it and spread it and spread it. Hence why they were in a state of war for nearly 416 years non-stop. And naturally, any state which is expansionist, and by the way, expansionist is a very, I don't like using the term, because expansionist has a, it's a word that has its meaning and grounding in colonial terms, right? But what I mean by expansionist in this sense is that the Ottomans perceived themselves as a domain which had to be spread by religious obligation. That it wasn't a case of we're going to go and colonize and loot. We need to spread this domain because it's something which we feel is better for humanity. And naturally, they were a militaristic state. Now, the Janissaries, who I mentioned in previous slides, was established by Murad the First. The Janissaries were made up of Slavs, Bosniaks, Serbs, Greeks, Armenians, Kurds, Turks, and they were an elite fighting force who were unique because they were ideologically grounded on two premises. Premise number one, our first duty, first and foremost, is to protect and defend the Sultan or the Khalif. Number two, we need to make sure that Osman's dream is being fulfilled. We need to make sure that the frontiers of the Ottoman state is not just being defended, that it is being expanded every day. So whenever certain Ottoman rulers slowed down the war pace a little bit, the Janissaries would be up in arms and they'd hold the Ottoman rulers to account, reminding them of Osman's dream, reminding them of the religious obligation of carrying the message of Islam and removing any obstacles to it. So the Janissaries were very, very ideologically driven. Very. And other, it's also been argued that they were the first pre-modern elite corps. So the modern equivalent would probably be, I don't know, the Navy SEALs or the SAS. I don't know. But they were regarded as the first pre-modern elite corps. And other empires and states at the time wanted to replicate the Janissary model, but they couldn't. They tried, like for example, the Safavids and the Mughals had the Sipais, and other European empires had their own version of what the Janissaries were. But Janissaries were known as warriors in the day and monks in the night. And they needed to be in a state of warfare and expansion and jihad, as understood by the Ottomans, constantly round the clock. But it can also be argued that the reason why they were so aggressive in this mindset was essentially they were paid. It was their salary, it was their livelihood. And eventually, the Janissaries became too powerful. They became too powerful, they became a state within a state. They literally held so much power that they would essentially choose who would be Sultan and who wouldn't. And there were many times where they rebelled, there were many times where there was civil unrest led by the Janissaries, and of course it was Mahmud II who felt that they were no longer an essential part of the Ottoman state, and he killed the remaining numbers of the Janissaries. And the Ottomans also stressed the importance of conscription as a religious obligation. I guess that's nothing really that different to any competing empires or states of the time, Christian or Muslim, whatever. You know, there was a strong emphasis on conscription. But they had implemented another unique system, and that was the Devishem system. The Devishem system was basically where the Ottomans would take one Christian boy from each household. So if there's more than one son, the Christian household would have to give one of their sons away towards the Ottoman military. And that was justified from the Ottoman perspective, and it was only applied to those regions and lands which had to be fought to be conquered. So the Ottoman understanding for this policy was that we lost men, we lost soldiers in taking this region, so therefore there has to be a form of compensation back from those who fought us. It must also be noted that many of those who went on to join the Ottoman military became the sole breadwinners and financial providers of their families. It is also documented, especially in Bosnia and Kosovo and in Serbia, that there were many, many Christian villages that actually gave and offered more than one son, because they went on to become, some of them went on to become bashas, some of them went on to become governors, some of them went on to become very powerful and wealthy men. The Ottoman state was a very tolerant and pluralistic state. I would go as far as to say that there was no other state or empire polity like the Ottoman state, period. Why? Because it was perhaps the most religiously diverse, the most ethnically diverse, and culturally diverse state of its time for centuries. And it managed to maintain a system of relative coexistence and a harmonious relationship between the different religions and races that existed within the state. And one of the indicators of this was the Millah system. Millah is the Arabic word, they call it the Millah system. The Millah system was whereby the Jews and the Christians would be allowed to establish their own courts and would refer to these courts for their disputes, and if they were unhappy with the decision, they'd refer back to the Ottoman Sharia courts. Now, it can be argued that this system is actually predates the Ottomans. That in fact, this was a system which was implemented by the Khulafa al-Rashidin, and in fact, there is a lot of basis for it in Islamic source texts. However, it was the Ottomans that actually centralized these courts. But they weren't just like, I wouldn't say rogue courts, but kind of like quasi-autonomous independent courts in their respective areas, and that was it. No, they were documented. They were centralized. All the rulings were documented. There was a representative from each Millah system, from each region. But it's also the fact that it was actually the Ottomans who actually had to, you know, implement this system in a reality and an environment which was really religiously diverse. Yes, okay, the Umayyads, the Abbasids, the Seljuks, even to some degree the Khulafa al-Rashidin, yeah, they may have had a similar Millah system, but the vast majority of the lands which they controlled were Muslim. Or those regions which they took, whether it be Egypt or the Levant or Persia or Central Asia, they eventually became predominantly Muslim. But the Ottomans had the real challenge of actually keeping together a society which in many parts of its empire was predominantly a majority demographically Christian. And it was a very administratively strong state. I posted a status on Facebook yesterday, because Brother Osama said, can you post something which we can share to hype the event up? Yeah? I said, there's no need. But I did, I posted a status, and it was a quote from Hussein Yilmaz's book. And Hussein Yilmaz, he described the Ottoman state. And he basically said that if the Abbasids, who were the legitimate seat of the caliphate before the Ottomans, if their legitimacy in the Islamic world was literally based on just some contractual acceptance. Now the Abbasids, without getting into it, you know, they became very weak very quickly. The reason why that is because they promised so many different entities and powers, Persian, Turkic, Sunni, Shia, they promised so much things to different elements who helped them overthrow the Umayyads that they lost a lot of power and influence very quick. However, they justified their legitimacy of being the caliphate based on certain contractual duties. For example, the Abbasid would be the ones who announce when Ramadan is. The Abbasid would be the ones who announce when Eid is. It would be the Abbasid that will give the verbal go-ahead before any military campaign. Just think about it, like a court which has many documents and there's just a kind of print of the Abbasid signature there. But really, you know, the competing and neighboring empires were significantly stronger militarily and economically. And one of the contractual conditions of the Abbasid was that no other competing empire, Muslim, would announce, declare themselves as the caliphate. So Hussein Yilmaz said that if that was the basis, the legitimacy of the Abbasid caliphate, the Ottomans were diametrically the opposite. They were completely different. They were grounded upon the fact that we were sovereign, we are the religious authority, and we are the lawmakers, which is starkly different to the Abbasids. And as a result of having that kind of worldview or ideology with regards to how they shaped their state, they had to be administratively strong. It was a very centralized state. Hussein Yilmaz went as far as to say that the Ottoman state from 1517 to the late to the early 19th century actually reflected and resembled that of the Khilafah of Omar in the way that it was so centralized, it was so watertight in the way taxes were collected, zakah was collected, jizya was collected, the way it was redistributed, the way certain budgets from the Baytul Mal was allocated. And these things made the Ottomans a very, very strong state administratively. Things changed, of course, as I will mention, I think in the next slide, that as the state was expanding, certain level of autonomy was granted to certain governors, and again, it began corruption and nepotism, which also contributed to the decline. But these were ultimately the characteristics of the state, of the Ottoman state. Achievements. Many achievements, far too many to mention, but just a few that I felt should be mentioned. The Ottomans were one of the first gunpowder empires, along with the Safavids of Persia and the Mughals of India. They were the first gunpowder empires before the Europeans. They had the first muskets, they had the first cannons in their ships, and so forth, which made them an effective fighting force for the best part of 150 years. As I mentioned about the Janissary corps, they were the first to create a modern elite corps that did not exist anywhere else. Other empires and other states had, specific fighting elements or military elements within their army, but none were ideologically driven and defined as the Janissaries were. And as I also mentioned in the previous state, that the Ottoman Empire really, really was a cosmopolitan, multi-ethnic, and religiously pluralistic state. Forget what Dili Hussein tells you, forget what the Ottomanist historians may tell you, go and read the accounts of European writers and historians. Those who went and visited Istanbul and other parts of the empire as late as the 1880s and 1890s, who said that we have not seen people of the Abrahamic faith live in such harmony. Was it not the case, I'm just jumping some of the points, that when the Spanish Inquisition took place in Spain after 1492, when the Catholic Castilians basically forced Muslims and Jews to become Christian or they were killed, nowhere else in Europe welcomed the Jewish people. Nowhere else. It was the Ottomans. And they didn't accept them as refugees. No. They welcomed them with open arms to say, come and settle here and flourish. Contribute to the Ottoman state. And they did. And there's Jewish poetry out there which testifies to the treatment in which the Jews had within the Ottoman state for many, many centuries. It was the Ottomans who, with the permission of Islam, brought Islam to Eastern and Central Europe. There was no Islam in Bosnia, or Kosovo, or Serbia, or Hungary, or Romania, or Bulgaria. Islam had not reached these parts, but it was the permission of Allah that it was through the Ottomans that Islam entered these lands and is still there today. There are still many, many Muslims in these countries, in these regions, till today. For those of you who have been to Istanbul and have been to the burial place of Abu Ayyub al-Ansari, it's known as Ayyub Sultan, you'll see that there's Muslims from the Caucasus, there's Muslims from the Balkans, there's Muslims from all parts of Europe. These people would not have been Muslim if the Ottomans did not bring Islam. It was not like And it's a point that has to be made. It was not like how when the Europeans entered and colonized many lands in Asia, Middle East, and Africa, that they wholeheartedly accepted the missionary work of the Christians, and then as soon as they left, they abandoned it. No, the Ottomans finished, but Islam remained. And you find that in many parts of the Islamic world today. They protected the Mediterranean Sea against pirates. Again, another huge major misconception, a myth, is that pirates were Arabs and Berbers and black Africans. Untrue. Untrue. The first piracy movements began in Europe. The first piracy movements began in Europe. Why? Because the Ottomans had a very strict monitoring system of the Mediterranean Sea, and they did not allow European powers to do as they wish in the Mediterranean. So the British and the Spanish and the Portuguese would commission mercenaries to try sabotage trade routes. It was the Ottomans who protected the Mediterranean for many centuries. As I mentioned earlier as well, many of the Ottoman Khulafa, they allocated from the waqf, from the religious endowment, a lot of money and resources to the preservation and renovation and infrastructure of the Hijaz and Ash-Sham, Mecca, Medina, Jerusalem. But even for those of you who have been to Mecca, you will find that there is a gate, I believe it's called the Ottoman Gate, an entrance. There's certain work that's been done to the Kaaba, which was done by the Ottoman rulers, as with Masjid al-Nabawi, as with Masjid al-Aqsa. There's Ottoman work that's carried out, that still remains in Cairo, in Syria, in Jordan. Another funny one is that under Khalifa Abdul Hamid, he also commissioned the creation of the first robot. A bit random, I know. There it is, that's an official Ottoman newspaper. He commissioned Japan to start building the first robot. It never happened. But who knows, maybe Japan's fixation with robots and AI and all that stuff may have been inspired by the Ottomans. Allah, I don't know. And it was another policy of Khalifa Abdul Hamid to have built a train line which went from Istanbul to Cairo to Damascus to Jerusalem to Mecca to Medina. And this was part of Abdul Hamid's pan-Islamic worldview, that he wanted to connect all these key Islamic cities that had a lot of history in them, that meant a lot to the Muslims, to build this train line to reconnect the key parts of the Ottoman state and make it easier to travel, to go pilgrimage, to do trade. Sadly, that project never materialized. Naturally, any state or empire or polity which span across three continents would have had to have a number of relations with competing and neighboring empires. The Ottoman state at its zenith and at its pinnacle, even towards the decline, it was still covered Middle East, North Africa, and Europe. As a result of that, the Ottomans for centuries had different relationships with different competing empires of its time. So just to quickly speed through it, the Byzantines, or the Eastern Holy Roman Empire, the relationship with them was always hostile. Again, for those of you watching the Delilish Ertul, this beef dates back to Ertul Ghazi. And so the relationship with the Byzantines was always hostile. And it's ultimately the Ottomans that delivered the final blow, which ended the Byzantine Empire. France, surprisingly, was the traditional European ally of the Ottomans for at least 200 years. The Austrian Habsburg Empire, the relationship with them was also very hostile. There were two famous sieges of Vienna, where under Suleiman I, literally, they had besieged Vienna, and had Vienna fell, the Ottomans would have entered Western Europe, but it didn't. And also the Austrian Habsburg Empire led a lot of the campaigns against the Ottomans because Hungary fell to the Ottomans under Khalid Suleiman I. So the relationship with the Austrian Habsburg was very hostile until World War I, where the Ottomans sided with the Germans and by extension they were allies of the Austrians. Russia was regarded as the arch enemy for 150 years. They would make major incursions towards the Balkans, and it is also believed that it was the Russian Empire who inspired a lot of the nationalist fervor in the Balkan area, because the Russians were Greek Orthodox. Many of the Balkan countries that were formerly Christian, they were mainly Greek Orthodox as well as Catholic. And in the late 19th century and early 20th century, the Russians played a key role along with Britain and France in inspiring separatist agitations within the Ottoman state. Germany was relatively a new state, right? When Otto von Bismarck unified the state, I believe it was in the 1860s, 1870s, don't quote me. So Germany was a relatively new state. But they were the final allies of the Ottomans in World War I. But it was Britain and France who were the annihilators. They were the ones who, as a result of World War I, and as a result of their own geopolitical interests in the region of North Africa and the Middle East, were the ones who essentially defeated the Ottoman Empire, namely through inspiring and leading and supporting what was known as the Arab Revolt. But the Ottomans also had relationship with Muslim powers, with the Safavids, who were theologically Twelver Shias. The relationship with them was hostile, because the Safavids would always attack the Ottomans' eastern flank when they were on European campaigns. And that was something that was always went to and fro, that whenever the Ottomans were on a European campaign, rest assured the Safavids would probably attack Iraq or Armenia or Azerbaijan or somewhere like that. So the relationship with them was hostile for political reasons, for religious reasons, for sectarian reasons. The Mamluks, also a hostile relationship. The Mamluks, let's not forget, they were too a very noble and prominent Muslim dynasty. It was the Mamluks who defeated the Mongols in the Battle of Ain Jalut. It was the Mamluks who fought the Mongols. It was the Mamluks who preserved the seat of the Abbasid Khilafah. Though the Abbasids held very little power, it was they who felt the religious importance to preserve that dynasty. But they had very hostile relations with the Ottomans, and eventually they were defeated. However, a number of very influential Mamluk tribal leaders still existed within Egypt, but they were sadly exterminated by an individual called Muhammad Ali Pasha, who was a kind of semi-autonomous governor of Egypt. He rounded all the remaining Mamluk elders in Cairo and he killed them. This was in the 1900s, the 19th century. And last but not least, the Mughals. For those of you who are from modern-day India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Afghanistan, the Ottomans had a very warm relation with the Mughals. In fact, there are documents in, I believe it's in a number of museums in Pakistan, but it's been documented that when the Mughal emperors used to write to the Ottomans, they used to refer to them as Amir al-Mu'mineen, as the Khulafa of the Ummah. They should write in their letters. This is stored in the Turkish historical archives. In fact, there's a specific letter from a Mughal emperor called Babur and Humayun, where they wrote to Khalid Suleiman I and other Ottoman rulers, I think it was Khalid Suleiman I and Murad IV, and in these letters, which are preserved today, they refer to the Ottoman rulers as Amir al-Mu'mineen, as the blessed Khulafa of the Ummah. It has also been documented that it was a very common practice in key cities within the Mughal Empire that every Jum'ah, as part of the khutbah, after praising the beloved Prophet, his family, his companions, they would also send salutations to the Ottoman rulers. It's documented. So their relationship was war with the Mughals generally, but there was also a theological an affinity with the Mughals. Why? Both states were Hanafi, both states were generally very Sufi, and they followed either the Ash'ari or Maturidi school of creed. So there's a lot of similarities in that regard. There were little periods of disagreements. Like, for example, when the Ottomans required the Mughals to militarily act to counter the British and the Portuguese, sometimes the Mughals were unable to do so. And likewise, when the Mughals required the Ottomans to militarily act to counter the Safavids, sometimes the Ottomans were unable to do so. So that created tensions during some period. But generally, Ottoman and Mughal relations were warm, and the Mughals went as far as to ceremoniously, at least, acknowledge the Islamic authority of the Ottomans. Reasons for decline. There's many, many reasons for decline, right? And it would be incorrect to identify one reason. It never really is one reason. There's usually a plethora of reasons which contribute towards decline. And the following are some of them. I have my personal views with regards to which were key reasons, but the following all played a role. Excessive autonomy and corruption. Now, when I said to you that the Ottomans grounded themselves in having a very centralized and tight-knit state, in order for taxes and levies to be collected properly, they had to grant governors a certain level of power and autonomy. Now, for those of you who have read a bit about the life of Umar radiallahu anhu, one of his sunnah was that he would regularly change governors. He didn't allow governors to stay in power for too long in case of corruption, in case that this governor will start building relations with the indigenous people, and therefore this will create nepotism and corruption. Umar ibn Khattab made sure that he changed governors very regularly. The Ottomans, once they realized that certain governors were doing a good job in collecting levies, in collecting taxes and redistributing it, that sadly began nepotism and corruption, and too much autonomy nearly always is a problem for any traditional empire or state of that time. There was an intellectual stagnation. The fact that a number of Ottoman ulama, they kind of closed the gates of ijtihad. And they felt that the laws and that they had codified and the canons that they had created, that it was sufficient until the end of times. And this was very problematic. It's very problematic because when it came to a case of advancing technologically, when it came to things which had new realities which had to be studied, that generally speaking, the Ottoman scholars or the leading scholars in the religious establishment generally had abandoned ijtihad in dealing with new realities at a time when Europe at least was moving at a rapid pace. With the Industrial Revolution, in terms of armament and weaponry, the printing press and so forth, the Ottomans in this regard and the ulama who made a lot of these just felt that, you know what we've got in hand is enough for us to last until the end of times. And that was a big problem. Also, what was indicative of this problem was the fact that when that time came, the early to mid 19th century, that is why you had elements of the Ottoman ruling elite seeking answers and solutions for their own state from Europe. So it can be argued to some degree in the defense of those who are regarded today as secularists and reformists and sellouts, they felt that there was not a robust approach internally to deal with new realities. So therefore we have to seek answers and solutions from another civilization or state which appeared to be moving with the times. A decrease in military campaigns. Remember that period I spoke about, 1740 to 1768, that 28 years of peace, that time where the Ottomans basically went into neutral, put their feet up, kicked back and started relaxing from the spoils of war. That period was a huge contributor to military decline. And I want to quote two very well-known Ottomanist historians. I highly recommend for you guys to get their book if you're interested in Ottoman history. Dr. Virginia Aksa, in her book Ottoman Wars, 1700 to 1860, An Empire Besieged, page 130, she said, The Ottoman Empire continued to maintain a flexible and strong economy, society, and military throughout the 17th and much of the 18th century. However, during a long period of peace from 1740 to 1768, the Ottoman military system fell behind that of their European rivals. And her colleague, Dr. Suraya Faruqi, who studied in Durham University, in her book, she echoed the same sentiment. She said, moreover, in the 18th century, when expansion definitely had ended, Ottoman military effectiveness and sultanic concern for army reform were not totally at an end. So while she acknowledged that military expansion was certainly came to an end, there was still a level of importance that was given to the military army. Hence why a number of reforms under the Tanzimat sought solutions from the Europeans. Nationalism was a massive blow, massive contributor to the decline of the Ottoman state. Because nationalism essentially was a European idea. It was an idea which was born out of the post-Enlightenment. It was born out of the Christian Reformation. It was born out of the Treaty of Westphalia. And it was nationalism which essentially was used in the Balkans by Russia. It was nationalism which was used by the British in the Arabian Peninsula. And it was nationalism which was a strong part of the Young Turks movement. For those of you who have read or come across some of the statements of the beloved Prophet and how he describes Asabiyya, whether you take it as tribalism or nationalism or racism, however you want to interpret it, it was something which he described as rotten, something which he spoke very, very negatively of. So it's no surprise that nationalism essentially was one of the contributors towards the decline of the Ottoman state. But it can also be counter-argued that did the Ottomans do enough? Whilst they may have claimed inclusivity or a pluralistic society, did they do enough for the people of the Balkans, for people of Central Europe, for the people of the Arabian Peninsula? Did they do enough to make them feel that they were part of this Ottoman Khilafah? Did they do enough? Because if they did, why was nationalism so easy to essentially implement and fracture the state? That's a counter-argument I want you all to perhaps think about. And the Young Turk movement, and generally the Western secular liberalism, the kind of new world order that was emerging or had emerged by the 19th century, naturally influenced elements of the Ottoman elite. The fact that, you know, Europe, who for the best part of 200-300 years were always behind the Ottomans, had now all of a sudden were miles ahead in nearly every aspect of statehood, whether that be economically, militarily. And so the Young Turks, to begin with, were fed up. They just felt that the Ottoman state was, and the different power holders within the state were not doing enough. But as time progressed, the collusion with European powers was borderlining treachery and treason. And last but not least, which kind of reiterates the above, there was basically a stronger, more advanced European enemies of the Ottoman state. Now, whilst I would not say that the Ottomans were the sick man of Europe, a derogatory term that was coined by the Russian Tsar to describe Khalifa Abdul Hamid specifically, but the Ottoman, that it was an alien and outdated and regressive state amongst other European empires that had embraced modernity, had embraced a new world. It's untrue. It's untrue. Because if the Ottomans were truly a sick man, it doesn't take much to destroy a sick man. It doesn't. But yet, this sick man, it survived for 100 to 120 years And even in World War I, it put up a great battle in Gallipoli, in Qut, in Iraq, as well as other parts. It put up brave efforts towards armies which were militarily and technologically more advanced. But if you ask me, that okay, from all these reasons, from all these contributors, what are the key ones? Definitely intellectual decline. A decline which basically meant that the Ottoman state, and I would also even the Muslim world, the Safavids, the Mughals as well, that they were just failing to deal with new realities. That the gates of Ijtihad really had closed, that they just weren't able, where there was a robust and flourishing approach of ulama to deal with new realities, in the way in which science and other arts and humanities and other things flourished for the best part of 1,000 years. Whether it's Abbasid Baghdad, whether it was Al-Andalus, whether it was whichever civilization you want to choose, there was never a case where Islamic civilization was behind any other civilization. The best part of it, for 1,000 years, it was ahead. And that's because the ulama at the time had such a pragmatic and open approach to new realities. There was never a conflict between Islam and exploration of new things. Never. Whether that be science or maths or philosophy or astronomy or the making of weapons or so, whatever it may be. But for some reason, towards the 19th century, for sure, that these things, this kind of robustness was not happening, this kind of creativity, this kind of very open approach to new things just wasn't taking place. And I also believe that this 28 years of peace, as harsh as it may sound, as harsh as you may think, whoa, man, come on, how can peace ever be a contributor towards decline? It was. 28 years of no military campaigns meant that for 28 years, those empires and states that essentially are your enemies and you're competing with, they were doing very well. They were given nearly 30 years of a breather of not having to deal with a hostile Ottoman Empire. And that contributed towards their decline. Because even if you look at European history from the period of 1740 to 1768, there were huge achievements made by Spain and Portugal, Britain and France and Russia in that period, whilst the Ottomans were chilling for 28 years. It could be argued that they were tired, they deserved a break. But why does that break contribute towards their decline? And last but not least, nationalism. There is no way that we cannot negate or downplay the role of nationalism. Nationalism, I would go as far as to say, is one of the biggest obstacles towards the Ummah's unity today. It's the biggest obstacles towards the unity of the Ummah today. It was Asabiya which prevented Quraysh from accepting the message of Islam, because Prophet ﷺ was from Bani Hashim. It was Asabiya which caused a number of arguments and frictions even in Medina amongst the Ansar. It was Asabiyya which was used to spark the Arab revolt, to say that Muhammad was an Arab. How could the Turks have an overlordship of Islamic authority? So these things put together certainly contributed towards the Ottoman decline. JazakAllah khair for everyone staying with me. Alhamdulillah, I've not seen many people knock out and put them to sleep. Look. Islamic history was not a utopian society. There has never been a utopian society. Even when our beloved Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, who was the greatest of mankind to have lived on this earth, when he established the first community of Medina, that was not a utopian state. There were still problems, there were still disputes, there were still crimes being committed. So when we discuss Islamic civilization history, be mindful not to present it in such a romanticized way where literally nothing could have gone wrong or nothing did go wrong. Many things, we had our faults and many problems, many cases of civil war, oppression, injustice, and many of these things. But we should not also fall into the other extreme And that is whereby we start adopting certain narratives, certain frameworks, to basically, when we start uttering some unsubstantiated propaganda about Islamic civilization. And the Ottomans are perhaps, they are perhaps the most dehumanized and demonized Muslim dynasty in Islamic history. And there's a number of things which within the Ottoman period did take place which were problematic, which in hindsight we can say was un-Islamic, but things which you can also say that was part of propaganda. Let's go through some of these things. Royal fratricide, the practice of brothers killing brothers. Islamically, in hindsight, in 2019, we can turn around and say, whoa, how do you justify, from an Islamic perspective, a brother, a Muslim killing a Muslim, a brother killing his brother? How do you justify that? Well, the Ottomans at the time, and the scholars at the time, they said, hold on here, what's worse? A brother killing a brother, one or two lives taken, or the risk of civil war, where thousands of people would be killed, where we give our enemies an opportunity to enter our state and our affairs and cause disunity? That's how they assessed it. That's how they assessed the harm and benefit, based on a previous track record, the Ottoman interregnum, the three sons of Sultan Murad I, who literally they invited the three sons, they allied with European powers that had always been the enemies of the Ottomans, just so they could compete for power. Thousands upon thousands of people died, Muslims and non-Muslims. To avoid that, it's just better off a brother killing a brother. However, fratricide is not a policy which is restricted or limited to the Ottomans. Many European powers and monarchies had this policy. The Romans had this policy. The ancient Greeks had such a policy. The ancient Egyptians had such a policy. Fratricide is not something that's limited or exclusive to the Ottomans. However, the Ottomans had, to their understanding, an Islamic justification for it. And that is that the unity of the state, unity of the Ummah, and the preservation of religion and life and security was greater than a brother killing a brother. Eunuchs were basically individuals, men, who were castrated, and they were kept in the royal palaces. I can't stand here and give any kind of religious basis for such policy, but the Ottomans did. They had men who basically had parts of their sexual organs snipped, and they used to basically guard the royal palaces, because the understanding was that those who can't procreate, but those who had bits snipped off, they were no longer deemed as men, so therefore our women folk were safe around them. It happened, it was real. I don't know why, I don't know how it was justified. I tried to do my research, there was no research behind it, except that many, this is the only thing I read, that many had offered to become eunuchs because of the lavish lifestyle that they were promised. Allah, but I can't see no justification for the use of eunuchs. Slave trade.
Were they slaves?
Pardon?
Were they slaves?
Who was whose slaves?
Those who were...
eunuchs?
Yes.
Many of them were, not all of them. Many of them were, not all of them. Some of them were free men who offered themselves, but many of them were slaves. But still, even if they were slaves, that act, like, I don't see how it could be justified. I've not heard any Islamic explanation from any schools of thought to justify such a policy. No such an act. The slave trade. The Ottomans were involved in slave trade, but they were not involved in the transatlantic slave trade. The global order whereby hundreds and thousands of free men and women and children in Africa were captured, sold, enslaved, and treated in horrific ways. Ottomans were not involved in that. That was predominantly a West African, American, British, and Dutch thing. The slave trade which the Ottomans were involved in was slave trade that was generally procured from war. So prisoners of war were taken as slaves and they would be sold in the markets. If there were certain regions that were taken by battle, it was a normal practice that before you went to war with a particular state or empire or region, the practice of the Ottomans, like it was with previous Muslim empires, was that white flag, let us in, accept Islam. Number two, pay us a jizya if you're not going to accept Islam. Number three is war. Number three is, if it's war, then that means whatever we do when we come into that city is ours. Again, I don't want you all to think that, oh my God, that sounds so barbaric. And it was something which, brothers and sisters and friends, again, was not exclusive or limited to the Ottomans or Muslim empires or states. That when a city or a country or a region or a land was taken by force, sadly it was the norm of that time, that men and women and children would be taken as slaves and sold off in markets. However, the Ottomans were not involved in the transatlantic slave trade. They were involved in a slave trade which was essentially born out of warfare. The Devishem system, the system which I spoke about, where we're coming to an end, don't worry, be patient with me, brothers and sisters. The Devishem system whereby a Christian household would have to give one of their sons to join the military, the Ottoman military, by law. It was mandatory. You know, there's a lot of controversy. Goes without saying the Ottomans committed a genocide against the Armenians. It's become an assumed truth, at least in Western European discourse. But let me explain to you the Ottoman perspective. The Ottoman perspective was this. Obviously, there were a number of incidents whereby there was nationalist agitations within modern-day Armenia, which is part of the Ottoman state. But the Armenian genocide is usually referred to an incident which took place in 1915, in the first year of war, World War I, where the Ottomans demanded from their Armenian citizens that we need a certain amount of men to fight for the Ottomans as part of our war effort. Keep in mind that Armenia was part of the Ottoman state. And Armenians were Ottoman citizens. And the Ottomans, in 1915, demanded, by law, that we want a certain number of Armenian men to fight for us. The Armenian leaders refused to give any men towards the war effort. In the eyes of the Ottoman state, that was treason. Secondly, there was, according to the Ottoman state at the time, evidence of collusion between the Russian Empire and the Armenians, in that the Russians would supply money and weapons for the Armenians to break away from the Ottoman state. Based on these two things, which was deemed as an act of treason, the Ottomans had expelled and exiled the Armenians and pushed them out towards the deserts of Syria, Deir ez-Zor, in eastern Syria. In that journey, many, many, many Armenians did indeed die. They died from malnutrition, from hunger, and I'm sure some were killed unjustly on the way there. We can't deny that. But from the Ottoman perspective, they saw it as an act of treason. And it goes without saying also that whilst in their journey towards that perilous journey towards Deir ez-Zor, the deserts of Syria, that when that opportunity arose, elements of the Ottoman army may have, in fact, did act unjustly. We shouldn't be shy about admitting this. However, was it a systematic genocide? Were they even in a position to carry out a systematic genocide, given that they were in a state of war from all fronts? It should also be noted that whether you accept what happened to the Armenians was an intentional and systemic genocide, or that it was an act of treason which resulted in them being expelled and therefore many Armenians died, however you want to see it, the point is, the Khalifa or the Sultan did not make this decision. Because by 1915, the three Pashas were running the Ottoman state. The Sultan had no executive power over these kind of policies. And last but not least, which I touched upon in a previous slide, were the Ottomans the sick man of Europe? No. Was it a state or a polity which seemed to have been behind its European counterparts in many areas? Yes. Yes. There was a war, I believe it was 1857, I could be wrong, the Crimean War. Britain and France allied with the Ottomans to fight the Russians. Britain and France used to use the Ottomans to counter Russian geopolitics. It's quite very normal. And the Crimean War was the first time that the Ottomans fell into debt, interest-based debt, with Britain and France. And this debt continued to increase, and it crippled the Ottoman state until the time of Abdul Hamid, rahimahullah, who tried his utmost best with radical fiscal policies to eradicate this debt. But was it a sick man of Europe? No, because as we all know, if you take the analogy of a sick man, you can pretty much kill off a sick man. It doesn't take 100 or 150 years to kill off a sick man. But was it an ailing empire? Was it an empire or a state that did have problems, that was not as militarily, economically, and politically astute and capable as its counterparts? There is truth to this. But the very fact that in World War I, even with weaponry that was less advanced to Britain, France, and Russia, the Ottomans still put up a fight and were successful in a number of key battles. They were the sick men of Europe. They had been defeated very easily. They weren't. In fact, it was the Arab revolt. It was a revolt. It was an internal strife that essentially delivered the final blow to the Ottomans. It wasn't an actual battle or war. It was the rebellion from the Arabian Peninsula. So brothers and sisters, those are the negatives. Some of this stuff is factual. Some of this stuff is Islamically indefensible. You cannot defend it. And some of this stuff is just propaganda. And we need to be smart enough when understanding Islamic history to have an objective approach. That yes, we accept that not everything within Islamic history and civilization was hunky-dory. Of course it wasn't. But at the same time, it wasn't all bad. Wallahi, it wasn't all bad. And has to be said, right? It has to be said. These little disclaimers and things have to be said. And the reason why it has to be said is because there's this mindset that, you know what, we're always talking about the Islamic great days. It's because a lot of the stuff was great. A lot of the stuff was great. Again, forget what Didi Hussein's telling you. Forget about what any Muslim was doing. There's European thinkers. You know, the vast majority, at least some of the very well-known Enlightenment thinkers, they spoke about it. Jean-Jacques Paul Rousseau, amongst others, spoke about Islamic civilization as being the kind of precursor, the intellectual precursor to their awakening. So we shouldn't be shy about talking about Islamic civilization in a positive manner, in a manner in which we inshallah want to see the return and replication of. But all I'm saying is, let's pipe you down a little, because a lot of it wasn't all perfect. Because some of the things that I experienced is that it was all good and no bad. And that's untrue, because what will end up happening if you have this approach to Islamic history, you're going to have someone who's just done a simple Google or Wiki check, and put their hands up and present to you some things from Islamic history, and you're going to be stuck. We have to appreciate and accept that there were many issues within Islamic civilization, that history there was. And how are we going to learn? How are we going to move forward as an ummah if we don't learn from the mistakes? If we don't acknowledge these mistakes? If we don't replicate these mistakes? Just be smart and vigilant and be objective in not falling into extremes. To conclude, why are the Ottomans so important to Muslims? It was the last central Islamic authority. You know, when we read the seerah, and we read about the life of the Prophet ﷺ, the Khulafa ar-Rashidin, the Umayyas, the Salaf al-Salihin, Salahuddin al-Ayyubi, Sayyid Qutus, Tariq bin Ziyad, and all these you know, these great leaders and armies and empires and polities. I'll be honest with you, sometimes, okay, maybe the Sirah and the companions are different because there's a different kind of affinity. But with the, beyond that, there is a disconnect. There is a disconnect in terms of time. There's a disconnect in terms of space. There's a disconnect because you can't really link back to the Abbasids, the Umayyads, and these previous classical polities. But with the Ottomans, you can, because they existed just 95 years ago. They are still great-great-grandchildren of Sultan Abdul Hamid that exist today. They exist. You can, those of you who are from North Africa and from the Arabian Peninsula, your forefathers, or maybe your families right now, are living the outcome of the destruction of the Ottoman state. There's a very interesting article in The Economist. I forgot who wrote it, I forgot the title. Just Google Ottoman Empire Economist. But they said that the author questioned that, would we really be seeing the destabilization and the carnage and the unrest that we're seeing in Middle East and North Africa had Sykes-Picot not happened? Where lines were drew over a bottle of shandy, a glass, and a ruler and a pencil, and literally drawing lines in regions and countries where people and different races had lived for centuries. Melting pots. Let's just draw lines. France, this is yours, this is mine. Yeah? That's literally what it is. And it wasn't just exclusive to the Middle East, North Africa. All of Africa's full of straight lines. Whenever you see a straight line, alarm bells should be ringing. That's not normal. Yeah? So, we are living, for those of you who follow events in Middle East and North Africa, we are living the aftermath of what happened after the destruction of the Uthmani Khilafah. They were the last Islamic authority. I know there's a whole debate around, after the Khulafa Rashidin, was any other entity or dynasty, were they really a Khulafa, were they kings? Yes, you know, there's a hadith in Musnad Ahmad which describes that after Khulafa Rashidin there'll be kingship and there'll be tyranny, etc., etc. And that true Khilafah only lasted for 30 years. Yes, these arguments exist. Some of them have legitimacy and truth in them. But the point is that ulama for 14th century, 13th centuries accepted these dynasties as Khulafa. And for all their faults and all their mistakes, they were the last embodiment. They were the last embodiment of any Islamic authority or polity which transcended borders and races as we understand it today. And they are the most closest to us in time. And in the UK, they are the most closest to us in terms of distance. And the reason why many revivalist organizations and movements and groups speak very fondly about the Ottomans, dare I say even romanticizing Ottoman history, is because they do it because they see within the Ottomans a hope and source of revival. For those of you who are big supporters of Erdogan, for those of you who follow Turkish politics very closely, it is not uncommon to see that in pro-AKP rallies and just generally rallies of that kind of spectrum, you'll see that flag there. That green flag with the three crescents was the flag of the Uthmani Khilafet. And those three crescents represented Asia, Africa and Europe. This green flag is now re-emerging in Turkey and other parts of the Muslim world. So this is why discussing the Ottomans, not just the Ottomans, generally Islamic history, is important for us. Because how do we move forward as an Ummah if we do not reflect upon our past, if we do not reflect upon our history, take from the good, learn from the bad, and try our best to never repeat the ugly? JazakAllah khairan for your patience.